All right, let's dive into this one. It's People v. Kevorkian. I think most people, even if you just graduated law school, have heard about this. Jack Kevorkian, Dr. Death, the whole debate around assisted suicide.
Yeah, it's infamous, right?
Totally. But the really interesting part, I think, is how this case, it happened in Michigan, really ended up shaping like the legal landscape across the whole U.S.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's so striking about this case is that, you know, Kevorkian was operating before Michigan even had a law against assisted suicide. And then after, so we're really talking about like uncharted territory, legally speaking.
It's almost like he was forcing the legal system to like catch up with this whole question of what is acceptable at the end of someone's life.
Right. Yeah.
So like, just to remind everyone, how was he actually assisting these suicides? What was his method?
Yeah, so he was using what he called a suicide machine, right? And it basically allowed patients to self-administer lethal drugs. And so that distinction between giving someone the means to end their life versus actually administering the final dose, that becomes so crucial to the legal arguments that unfold in this case.
Okay, so let's sort of like walk through the legal timeline here. Michigan eventually did pass a law against assisted suicide.
They did, yeah. In 1992, that law came into effect, and it basically set the stage for this clash between what Kevorkian was doing and this newly established law.
Right.
And, you know, what's interesting is we're not talking about one isolated incident here. The case that went before the Michigan Supreme Court, it was actually a bunch of different appeals kind of bundled together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, some dealt with charges from before the law existed, some challenged the new law itself, so it gets pretty messy.
So trying to figure out, like, actions committed when it was kind of a legal gray area, and then also whether the law itself is constitutional all at the same time.
Yeah, it was a lot for the courts to deal with.
Yeah, that sounds like a real headache.
Totally. And to make things even more complex, you know, Michigan law has this thing called a saving clause.
Oh, right.
To put it simply, it basically meant that even if there wasn't a specific statute against assisted suicide at the time, like in those early cases, prosecutors could still try to go after Kevorkian because it could be considered a common law crime.
Wait, hold on. So even without a specific law, they could still prosecute?
Yeah, potentially. It kind of hinged on whether assisted suicide was actually considered a common law crime in Michigan's history, which is a whole other debate.
Yeah, that's a whole other can of worms.
Exactly. And on top of all that, there were arguments that the assisted suicide statute itself was unconstitutional, both under Michigan's constitution and the U.S. Constitution.
Okay, let's break those down. Like, what were the main arguments against the Michigan law being constitutional?
All right, so on the state level, they argued that the statute violated this thing called the Title Object Clause.
I vaguely remember that from law school.
Yeah, so basically, imagine you have like a grocery list, right?
Yeah.
And you start adding things like car parts and concert tickets to it. It's just too broad. It's not focused on one subject.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
Exactly. So they argued the assisted suicide bill was kind of similar. It covered too much. It went beyond what it was supposed to be about.
So it was kind of a messy law, legally speaking.
That was the argument.
Okay, and then what about on the federal level?
Right. So on the federal level, they said it violated the 14th Amendment, specifically the Due Process Clause. They basically argued that people have a right to make end-of-life decisions, and they compared it to the right to refuse life-sustaining treatment, which had been established in cases like Cruzan v. Director.
Interesting. So they were trying to connect it to, like, existing case law about medical autonomy.
Yeah, exactly.
But the court didn't buy that, right? They didn't say there's a constitutional right to assisted suicide.
No, they didn't. They kind of drew a distinction, right? They said refusing treatment is letting nature take its course, while assisted suicide is, like, actively seeking to end your life. The state, they argued, has an interest in protecting life and preventing suicide.
Right, that makes sense.
But, and this is where it gets really tricky, is how do you legally differentiate between murder and assisted suicide, especially with someone like Kevorkian involved?
Right, because he was facing both types of charges. Right?
Exactly. So there was this previous case, People v. Roberts, and that case had suggested that just giving someone the means to commit suicide could be enough to get you charged with murder.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But the court in Kevorkian, they decided to overturn that part of Roberts.
Okay, so they were saying just providing the means isn't enough to be considered murder.
Right. They basically established a new standard. They said to be convicted of murder in these cases, the death had to be the direct and natural result of the defendant's actions.
Direct and natural result. Okay.
So, like, Think of it this way. Handing someone a loaded gun is different from actually pulling the trigger yourself.
Right. Right. Yeah.
One is assisting, the other is like directly causing the death.
So that's the line they drew, providing the means versus performing the final action.
Exactly.
But didn't that create like a whole new set of problems? What about situations that fall somewhere in between? Like what about a doctor who prescribes lethal medication?
That's a great question. And to be honest, the court didn't really fully address that. Even one of the judges who agreed with the majority decision, Justice Boyle, she criticized this new standard, saying it created this artificial separation between like medicine and morality.
So even with this new standard, there's still a lot of ambiguity.
Oh, absolutely. Tons of ambiguity. And that ambiguity, wouldn't you say, is even more pronounced today with things like, you know, telemedicine and all of that?
Oh, for sure. Now we're in a world where you can have like remote consultations and prescriptions.
Yeah.
So if a doctor in one state like assists a suicide that happens in another state, all through telemedicine, how does that even fit into this direct and natural result idea?
Yeah, it's really hard to say. It's like the law is constantly trying to catch up with technology.
Totally. And I think that's what makes Kevorkian so fascinating, even all these years later. You might not have given us all the answers, but it definitely forced the legal system to start dealing with these incredibly complex questions about like end-of-life choices. It was a turning point, even if it left us with more questions than answers.
Definitely.
So we've got this really intricate case, all these legal challenges, this new standard for figuring out what's murder, and a whole bunch of unanswered questions.
Yeah, that about sums it up.
So, like, what does it all mean for the average person? Why should we care about People v. Kevorkian all these years later?
That's the key question, right? It's not just about one doctor. It really makes us think about these big ideas like individual autonomy versus the state's interest in protecting life. Like, what is a good death? Who gets to decide? How do we balance individual rights with the need to protect people who might be vulnerable? These are questions that affect all of us.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack.
Definitely, a lot to unpack. And, you know, as technology and medicine keep advancing, these questions are only going to get more complex and more challenging.
Absolutely. Well, we've just started scratching the surface here. Let's dive even deeper into the impact of People v. Kevorkian when we come back.
Welcome back. You know, before the break, we were discussing how People v. Kevorkian really grappled with these, you know, big moral and legal issues. And it almost feels like the case was a preview of sorts of like the kinds of debates we're still having decades later about assisted suicide.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And like Justice Mouth's dissent, right? All his arguments about a terminally ill patient's right to, you know, choose how they die, even with assistance, those arguments have become so central to the whole right to die movement. It's almost like he could see where things were heading.
Absolutely. He was ahead of his time in a lot of ways. And, you know, even though this case was in Michigan, right, its impact really went way beyond just the state. Like, think about Oregon's Death with Dignity Act.
Right, right.
You know, that law, which allows physician-assisted suicide under, you know, very specific circumstances, it was definitely influenced by all the discussions that were sparked by the Kevorkian case.
Yeah, it's interesting because even though the Michigan court ultimately upheld the state's ban on assisted suicide,
right,
it's like, in a way, they also kind of opened the door for other states to try different approaches. Like, they were acknowledging that this is a really complicated issue.
Exactly. And this actually connects directly to a really important Supreme Court case, Vacco v. Quill. This was decided just a few years after Kevorkian. And in Vacco, the Supreme Court, they upheld the right of states to ban assisted suicide. But they made this really crucial distinction. They said there's a difference between refusing life-saving treatment, which, you know, was already legally protected, and actively seeking help to end your life.
So basically, they were reinforcing that line that the Kevorkian court tried to draw between like letting nature take its course versus actively choosing to die.
Exactly. So Vacco, along with another case decided the same day, Washington v. Glucksberg, those two cases really solidified this idea that in the U.S., there's no like constitutionally protected right to assisted suicide. But, and this is really important, states can choose to legalize it if they want to. So it's this really interesting balance between federal law and like what states can do on their own.
Yeah, it's a really complicated legal landscape for sure.
Mm.
So even though Kevorkian didn't create some kind of like national right to assisted suicide, it definitely feels like it pushed the conversation forward. Like, it forced people to actually deal with the issue.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely put the whole issue on the map, so to speak. Like, it wasn't just this, you know, abstract concept anymore. It was a real legal battle with real people involved.
Right.
Lawmakers, courts, everybody had to actually deal with the complexities of it all.
It's almost like Kevorkian was this catalyst for change, even if the change didn't happen right away or, you know, in the same way across the entire country.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. But here's the thing, right? While Kevorkian did clarify some things legally about assisted suicide, it also left us with a ton of unanswered questions.
Right, right.
Like, remember that direct and natural result standard, the one they used to determine if it's murder?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it might sound clear at first, but there are, like, so many gray areas when you actually start applying it.
Yeah, that was my question earlier about, like, what about a doctor who prescribes lethal medication? I mean, it's not handing someone a gun, but it's also not doing nothing.
Yeah. Exactly. Where does that fall on the spectrum of, you know, assisting versus causing?
Right.
And that's just one example. Like, what about a doctor who gives a patient information about lethal doses, knowing that the patient's going to use it? What about situations where a doctor helps a patient, you know, travel to a state where assisted suicide is legal?
It seems like there are, like, endless scenarios that could end up in that gray area.
There really are. And all those gray areas, haven't they become even more complicated now because of technology, like with telemedicine, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now you could have a doctor in one state, you know, potentially helping someone end their life in another state, and it's all happening over a video call.
Right, exactly. And how do you apply these, you know, older legal standards to something like that?
It really feels like the law is always playing catch up with technology, especially in medicine, where things are changing so fast.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And I think that's what makes Kevorkian, you know, so relevant today. Even though it was decided back in 94, the questions it raised are, like, more important than ever.
You know, when we first started talking, you mentioned how this case might, like, haunt us into the next century. I'm starting to see what you meant.
Right. As medicine and technology keep advancing, we're going to keep running into these, like, really complicated end-of-life questions. And Kevorkian, it's almost like it gives us a way of thinking about those questions, even if it didn't give us all the answers.
It sounds like the case really highlighted that tension between individual autonomy and, you know, the state's role in protecting life, but also, like, the limitations of the law when you're talking about these very personal ethical choices.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. It's about, you know, understanding all the nuances, acknowledging the different perspectives, and recognizing that there's no one right answer for everyone.
Well said. It feels like we've covered a lot, but there's still more to discuss, right?
Definitely. Like, as we move further into the 21st century, this whole intersection of technology, medicine, and end-of-life choices, it's only going to get more complex.
Yeah.
We haven't even touched on things like gene editing or, you know, how AI could potentially change how we view death and dying.
Oh, my brain is already hurting thinking about all that.
Mine too. But that's what makes it so interesting, right? It challenges us to really think about what it means to live and to die in a world that's, you know, changing faster than ever.
Definitely. Well, on that note, maybe we should all take a moment to process everything. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about People v. Kevorkian and what it all means for, like, the future of end-of-life care.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We've been talking all about People v. Kevorkian, and it's pretty clear that this whole debate about assisted suicide, I mean, it's not going away anytime soon. Not at all. And I think as we, you know, move further into the 21st century, we're going to run into even more complicated questions, especially as technology and medicine keep changing so rapidly. Like, think about all the breakthroughs we're seeing with, like, gene editing and artificial intelligence and even personalized medicine. I mean, these things could really extend our lifespans in a big way and change how we experience aging, you know?
Yeah.
But they also bring up new questions about what it means to have a good death in this, like, new world. Got and it. Who gets to make those choices, you know?
Right. It's like we're constantly pushing the limits of, like, what's possible, both with, you know, keeping people alive longer and also having a say in how they die.
Exactly. And that's why I think the legacy of People v. Kevorkian is so important. Even though it happened decades ago, it still gives us a way to think about these really complex issues.
So what would you say are the, like, key takeaways from Kevorkian that we should keep in mind as we, you know, navigate these new challenges?
Well, I think the biggest one is that tension between, you know, what an individual wants and what the state's role is in protecting life. The court basically said people do have a right to make decisions about their bodies and their medical care, but the state also has an interest in preventing suicide and making sure vulnerable people are safe.
Right, it's like, how do we balance those two things?
Right, and finding that balance is only going to get harder as technology keeps developing. Like, imagine a future where AI can, like, predict with almost perfect accuracy when someone's going to die. Does that change the way we talk about assisted suicide? Does it give people more control, or does it create like a whole new set of ethical problems?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. It seems like the more we learn, the more complicated these decisions get.
For sure. And that brings us to another important point from Kevorkian. We need really clear definitions and boundaries in the law. Like, remember how the court decided to overturn that earlier case, People v. Roberts, and create that new standard for murder, the direct and natural result test?
Yeah, the whole analogy about, like, handing someone a loaded gun versus pulling the trigger.
Exactly. But like we were saying before, real life is rarely so black and white. Like, what about that doctor who tells a patient about lethal doses of medicine? What about those situations where a doctor is helping a patient, you know, travel to a state where they can legally get help with dying?
Right. There are so many scenarios that fall into this, like, gray area.
Totally. And it's almost like we need a whole new set of legal terms to talk about these new issues in end-of-life care.
You might be right. And it's not just about the laws, you know? It's about all of us, as a society, being open to having honest conversations about death, talking about our values, what we're afraid of, what we hope for at the end of life.
I agree. It can be hard to talk about death, but it's something that affects everyone, you know? It doesn't matter what you believe or where you come from.
Right.
And these conversations, even though they can be tough, I think they're really important for figuring out a better way to deal with end-of-life care. It's about respecting individual choices, but also protecting people who are vulnerable. It's about, like we were saying before, finding that balance.
Well said. So I guess, where do we go from here? What are the questions we should be asking ourselves as we, you know, try to figure all this out?
I think the biggest question is, what does it really mean to die with dignity in today's world? How do we balance what an individual wants with keeping vulnerable people safe? What should technology's role be in end-of-life care? And maybe, most importantly, how do we make sure that everyone has access to, like, compassionate care at the end, no matter what they choose?
Oh, those are really big questions. I don't think there are any simple answers.
No, definitely not. But they're important questions to think about. And as technology keeps advancing and the line between life and death gets even blurrier, talking about these things is only going to become more important.
This deep dive into People v. Kevorkian has been really, really insightful. Thank you for, you know, walking us through this complex legal stuff and helping us understand what it all means.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. And, you know, this isn't just some theoretical debate happening in a courtroom somewhere. These issues affect all of us. Let's keep the conversation going and keep trying to build a world where everyone can die with dignity and peace.
That's a great way to put it. And to our listeners, thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive. Keep thinking about these issues, keep having conversations, and let's all work towards a better future for end-of-life care.